bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Heck yeah, wasn't even holding a cup this time, but I'm going to drink in the middle of my sentence.
Do it. Justin Robert Young.
Hi, it's me, Justin Robert Young.
What an intro. Gentlemen, you want to jump right into some weird here?
Yeah, I do.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking
One of our favorite online comics, as everybody else, Randall Monroe, does XKCD.
Heck yeah.
And he had, I think it's the most recent one. Let me go there. I love it because this guy, he's so smart. He's just like so smart, and the way he thinks about things makes me go, wow, I wish that was that smart. So he has this graph, and it's this graph of mysteries going from not that weird to weird as hell, and then ranked with I have no explanation or the explanation seems pretty clear. I was familiar with most of these mysteries. I would say actually I was familiar with all of them except for one, and then I'm like, wow, that's really weird. And I want to direct your attention to the far right, upper right corner, lead masks case.
Okay, well just let's I'm sure you know more of these than Justin and I will. Just to explore, and by the way, this is at xkcd.com. In the far bottom left corner, which means not that weird and explanation seems pretty clear, he's got why I keep putting ice cream back in the fridge instead of the freezer. Mysteries, I have no explanation and not that weird. In the upper left corner, he's got who Carly Simon's singing about in You're So Vain. But in the far upper right, in that I have no explanation and it's weird as hell, he has MH370. Are you saying you know which one that is?
That would be the airplane.
Oh, shoot. The flight. The Malaysia Airlines. Yeah, yeah. Got it. Okay, that's good. And then, wow. I'm familiar with the story of D.B. Cooper. Salish sea feet? I don't know anything about
those. Are the feet that wash ashore in like British Canada?
Oh, geez. Wow. Marie Celeste, I'm familiar with. The Wow signal. Is that a radio transmission?
Yeah, that was it aliens? You know, it was a narrow band signal picked up by, I think, SETI or whatever. We still haven't figured out. Was that
got
burst?
It. The Lindbergh baby, of course, the baby got kidnapped. UVB-76, I'm not familiar with.
I believe that's a planet, UVB-76. Shortwave. Oh, that's the radio station. That's the one that puts out the weird sort of stuff that, you know, maybe spies or drug dealers are giving out codes.
Okay.
Right. The number station?
Yeah.
Yeah, we've covered that.
Zodiac letters. That's the serial killer, right?
Yeah.
Amelia Earhart, of course, went missing. Lost Colony. I assume that's Roanoke he's talking about.
Yeah.
Kentucky meat shower. Is this like one of those frogs and fish falling from the sky?
I think so.
Yeah. Bigfoot, Loch Ness Monster, Dyatlov Pass incident. I don't know that one.
That's this weird, probably was an avalanche, but it was this weird, you know, one where a bunch of hikers and all that got killed in the middle of Russia somewhere.
And the Voynich manuscript, that's not the one that like they built their own language just to fool people.
Yeah, the weird descriptions of weird plants, things like this.
Got it. All right. Well, cool. So I also have no idea what the lead masks case is. Justin, do you have any idea?
I am baffled by many of these, but from the lead masks case, I have no idea.
Can Justin and I take a guess before you explain it to us?
You can guess, and then I'm going to have you go to Wikipedia and look it up and describe it to our audience.
Okay.
All right. Well, here let's guess before we yes. Google lead masks. I'm going to go ahead and say it is some kind of. For whatever reason, my mind's immediately going to kidnapping or some kind of horror where people are put in lead masks. Or
see, like, I would say like kind of like the crystal skull was found in burial sites, you know, among the Aztecs. I'm going to say lead masks is a similar kind of sarcophagus mystery, like something with I picture it over the face of a mummy and has a curse on it or something.
See, I kind of feel like it would. So if we're looking at the weirdest possible thing. if the only thing that remains of something that would be like intensely bizarre are lead masks.
Oh, wait, what about this? What if there's this is way weird scenario, but what if there's a tribe that had lead poisoning so bad that when their bodies decayed, only the lead was left behind, forming like the shape of a face, like a lead mask?
I mean, but that's also that. I mean, that would be a tantalizing possible explanation. But like, we're really, this is the mystery, right? So it's like, if anything, we got to be thinking of the most mysterious item you could find that involves the concept of lead masks. Okay, and
I might have a slight clue before I click on this. When I typed in lead masks, it auto completed it to lead masks case. So both the XKCD and the autocomplete says that it's a case. So I don't know if that's a case file. Maybe it's a serial killer or something who never got caught and left lead masks all over the place.
See, I think that's where I'm going to, like, because also that creates a more of a mystery in terms of like a lead mask. You might imagine to not be very easy to build. You're not going to buy it at the Piggly Wiggly. Like it is, if there is evil intention behind a lead mask, then the person behind it is, you know, mysterious in even just how much time they're putting into it.
All right.
What if I told you it all took place in a place called Latveria?
Wait a minute.
No.
I was about to say, Latveria is the made-up Dr. Doom country, right?
That would be pretty awesome.
That would be amazing. Okay, here we go. I'm clicking on the Wikipedia article, and it says, from Wikipedia, the lead masks case, Ocaso das Mascaras de Chumbo, sorry to everyone who speaks Portuguese, was a series of events which led to the death of two Brazilian electronic technicians, Manuel de Pereira de Cruz and Miguel Jose Viana. Their bodies were discovered on August 20th, 1966. On the afternoon of August 26, 1966, a young man was flying a kite on the Morro do Vintem Hill in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, when he came upon the bodies of two deceased males and reported them to the authorities. The area had a difficult terrain, but police were unable to reach the bodies until the next day. When a small team of police and firefighters arrived on the scene, they noted the bodies' odd conditions. The two males were lying next to each other, slightly covered by grass. Each wore a formal suit, a lead eye mask, and a waterproof coat. There are no signs of trauma and no evidence of struggle in the surrounding area. Next to the bodies, police found an empty water bottle and a packet containing two wet towels. A small notebook was also identified, in which were written the cryptic instructions, 1630, estar no loco determinado.
Just skip to the English.
Skip to the English. It says, 4:30, be at the specified location, 6:30, ingest capsules. After the effect, protect metals, await signal mask. Oh, my God. So did they, let's see, they were identified by their names. Following an investigation, police reconstructed a plausible narrative. On August 17th, Cruz and Viana left their city, which with the stated intent that they needed to purchase some materials for work. The two men boarded a bus and arrived at 2:30 p.m. Evidence shows that the waterproof coats were purchased at a shop there. One bottle of water from a bar. Upon being interviewed, the waitress from the bar described Miguel as very nervous. That is the last time they are known to be seen alive. It's presumed they went directly from the bar to the spot at which they were discovered. They didn't find anything at the scene, nor after an autopsy. They did not do a search for toxic substances. The coroner's office was very busy at the time, and when the autopsy was finally conducted, the internal organs of the two victims were too badly decomposed for reliable testing. Holy
pause cow. Right there. Weird enough for you?
Yeah.
Is it weird for you?
That's pretty weird.
Well, yeah, you know, listen, like, very weird, but it's a cult thing, probably, right?
Brian,
like,
continue.
So, keep reading. You want me to keep reading? Okay.
Suggested explanations.
In the week following the incident, the Journal de Brazil recorded a local resident reported having seen an orange oval-shaped object hovering off the top of the hill, sending out rays in all directions. Another newspaper quoted a professor of yoga as speculating that the men had been experimenting with high-frequency thought waves using alkaloids such as LSD-25 and mescaline to step up the brain. So here's what I feel like, Justin, is that I don't care if it is a cult or not, because if it's aliens, that's weird enough for me. But if it's a cult, a mysterious cult that we still don't know anything about, that's out there, that is so powerful that it got two guys to get up on a hill and commit suicide with their lead masks, that's just as mysterious to me.
Certainly so. No, I mean, like, without a doubt, there is, like, there is definitely a eerie nature to the to anything that could force two people to, because even in their minds, if this wasn't like a Hail Bop style, we're all going to kill ourselves at the same time kind of thing, they were looking to do some sort of like beyond our beyond human comprehension kind of experimentation with the pills that they were given, right? Like, maybe they didn't think that they were killing themselves. They thought that they were going to experience another level of consciousness or something.
If
like
you
that.
Click on Google image search for lead masks case, you can actually see the masks.
Okay, here we go. Images.google.com and lead masks case. I'm kind of scared to see. Okay, so they've got... I'm seeing a lot of the faces, and I guess these are just like crazy sunglasses.
Yeah.
Made of lead, they're masks, and you can't see through them unless you're, you know, Kreskin.
Yeah. Man, that's dark. Hey, do we know anything? And this is, I don't know.
No, we don't, Brian.
Apologies if this is too much of a random side jag, but I'm wondering about the prevalence of cults in different areas. Do we know, like, if one area is more prone to cults than others? Like, I would imagine somebody's done a study like that.
You know, it's fascinating because you start, when you start getting into fringe beliefs and stuff, and the short answer is I don't have an answer to that, but I can tell you that when you go around the world, we tend to think of cults in a very sort of narrow sort of way, but then when you start to think about it, there are a lot of them, a lot of different ones, very regional, weird ones in Russia. You know, you have in you know, and then you have big ones like in China, Falun Gong. You know, all over, you're going to find offshoot, and you know, it's how every religion essentially starts, as some sort of weird thing that then becomes its own thing.
Yeah, isn't I forget where I heard it, but it's like somebody at some point, I believe, said that the difference between a cult and a religion is 50 years. Like, if it's still alive after 50 years, it's now a religion. And
well, and I don't know. That's working for the Church of Scientology.
It certainly is from a tax perspective, you know.
Well, I think that the difference is that for the most part is it inward or outward facing. If a cult tells you stop talking to other people when they're not part of it, then they're going to be isolated, and if they have a lot of secrets, you know, they're always going to be very opaque. And most of your very, very modern religions are very open. You understand, your doors are open, walk in there, whatever. There aren't a lot of secrets. There might be some in sort of the organizational level, but you know, you can walk into a Mormon temple and say, hey, what's going on? And they'll talk to you, whatever, hang out. There's not going to be a big, huge recruitment sort of thing where they want your bank account info. And it took a long time for them to gain acceptance, but as they become more open, you know, it's commonplace.
Speaking of Scientology, I'm guessing neither of you guys have seen that HBO documentary based on Going Clear yet.
No, I almost went to go see that we're doing a screening here, but it comes, I think it's on HBO next week.
I think it just came out, actually.
Oh, sweet.
I want to say it was on the 16th, because I remember during South by Southwest, I was like, oh, we're just going to miss the chance to watch this together. So I really want to see that. After reading Inside Scientology, you know, I've always been fascinated by the cult of personality, and I mean specifically the cult of personality, not calling them a cult. Scientology's lawyers, back off. But in Inside Scientology, it gives an almost sympathetic view of L. Ron Hubbard's intention, but then is ruthless in describing how David Miscavige has run everything since he ascended to power, with the horrific and chillingly accurate phrase. I realize, you know, he comes out of a meditation or locked in the room for a few days and comes out of the room, according to one of his friends, saying, I get it now. power isn't granted, it's assumed. And then he goes on to prove that exactly right over the next 5 years as he takes over Scientology.
Yeah, it is a, you know, a fascinating story. You know, is there something, you know, just to keep it more general, like, is there a religion that falls below cult level? Like, does that, you know, is everything just get the cult moniker, or are there examples of, hey, let's do a bunch of religious-y, churchy kind of stuff, but we're not going to get the C word thrown at us?
No. I think if you're not, if you're open and you're not that far from the norm, if you're a little bit off from what people consider mainstream where you are, you're fine. But when you have new revelations, when you say, oh, we have information that's outside biblical revelations, then people are like, well, you're saying you have a different conduit to God, you know, and that's when it becomes.
I would say that the closest thing I could think of that meets that description is the whole belief in the secret. And I don't know if we're seeing that kind of go on its way out.
Right.
Over the last
we can't
10 years.
Talk about that.
But the whole idea, you know, the success guru, the secret, just, you know, think really hard, wish it, and it'll come true because
why
of
every
mysterious...
woman's married to George Clooney.
Yes, exactly. I guess that's the closest thing I could think of because nobody, I haven't heard anyone call that a cult yet. Or at least not seriously.
Is it so? All right. So what are our baseline? Like, let's say we're building a cult. You know, a
hypothetically,
thought that Andrew
theoretically.
Yeah. Let's say a thought that Andrew has only had once or twice a day. what do you need? What are your baseline? Like, you gotta have these things if you're gonna be a cult.
You absolutely have to have a charismatic center personality, right? Somebody that around which everything nucleates. You don't think that's true? From your
I don't know because I can think of things that have really succeeded post founder. You take like Urantia. You know, in Urantia, there's a lot of stuff that's based around books or ideas.
I don't know what Urantia is.
Urantia, type in U-R-A-N-T-I-A.
Okay.
And I'm sure there was probably at the beginning was some sort of charismatic person at the start of it. But there's like, we don't know who the author is supposed to be of that. And I've met very intelligent people who are into this sort of, you know, it's kind of a Christian UFO book sort of thingy.
Huh. Yeah, it says, the writings in the Urantia book instruct us on the genesis, history, and destiny of humanity and on our relationship with God the Father. They present a unique and compelling portrayal of the life and teachings of Jesus. They open new vistas of time and eternity to the human spirit and offer new details of our ascending adventure in a friendly and carefully administered universe. Huh. It says it's not a religion per se, but it builds upon existing religions.
Yeah, well, anytime you have some sort of revelation that sit outside of conventional, you know, then you kind of are.
So does cult have to have let's go the other way. Is there a necessary element of religiosity that you have to be a cult? Like, do you have to offer some of the benefits of a religion if you want to be in a cult?
So you're saying that does there need to be a supernatural element for it to be a cult?
Yeah. Or yes. I mean, like, if not straight supernatural, like certainly like, you know, Buddhist or, you know, some philosophical, you know, like, you know, you are doing better because we understand the way of the world.
I mean, I would say that certainly that seems to be the case with, you know, yogic cults. What was that movie that I watched on Netflix that the guy just decides to start his own yogi cult? And then at the end reveals to everyone that he's just a kid from New Jersey.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. I think that, like, if you start with and you say, we have our own ethics and beliefs that are outside of mainstream, and we think some things are okay that mainstream society does not, you know, it's one thing to be – you can be more conservative and say, well, you know – we don't smoke. Well, that's not cool. But if you're like, no, we think you can do X, Y, or Z, and we maybe there's some behaviors we want to keep secret from outside society. There are a lot. I think it's a Venn diagram. They think there are a lot of things you contribute. You can have, you know,
in politics, you have a number of groups that essentially were cult-like in its, you know, formations. You know, the different mm-hmm. socialist groups, you know, that formed either the Nazi Party or the Communists. You know, you had people that were functioning within there. They had an ethics and they had their own belief system that was not, you know, that was sort of stand out from what was conventional.
By the way, real fast, our intrepid producer, Neshcom, nailed it. It was Kumare, K-U-M-A-R-E. It's definitely worth watching. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I mean, it's you see, you know, we want an explanation. You know, it's that drive for we want somebody to say, this is the universe. This is your place in it. This is the keyhole. Yeah. This is how you're the key. You know, we just want that. We want that to all have. And that's why, as you point out, Brian, often charismatic leaders can start these things because they can create this narrative, the story that you go, oh, finally, my life makes sense.
I got one that might satisfy the requirements per Justin's question. If you read Michael Shermer's book, How Why People Believe in Weird Things, he takes like a chapter to talk about what happened to Ayn Rand's closest followers. They essentially, you know, closed off their group. It became all about essentially worshiping the people who were closest to Ayn Rand. And even though, you know, she, you know, advocated, as I read it, you know, that the merits of thought should stand on their own. Instead, it became very political and it became like, no, that's outside the dogma because you were sleeping with so-and-so, therefore you're banished. And, you know, it had all the trappings of a cult without a supernatural characteristic to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was one of the frustrating things to see with objectivism was to see that it became something that should not have been personality centric became personality centric, and I think that was sort of lended to her, you know, her idea that of objectivism could apply even to things that we might consider subjective, like art and things like that. Like,
holy
this
cow.
Is good, that is bad. That's my objective opinion, and kind of a. I found Ayn Rand very, very inspiring, but her understanding of science and empiricism was limited.
Strengths in the chat just forwarded us to this the Venn diagram of irrational nonsense that has a kind of four different circles, including quackery, religion, pseudoscientifics, and paranormal, and in the center of all of it is Scientology, in that it's the Venn diagram in the middle of all four of those.
Yeah. Well, hit all those vectors.
Yeah. Oh. So anyway, if you're a member of Scientology, just write us at P.O. Box 666. Please don't bother us, Lane. And we're sorry.
I got news for you, too. If you're a hardcore Sea Org member, you're not listening.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, I've known ex-members who were like they said, yeah, I could. They're like, I could have maybe told you who the president was, maybe, but it was just so not relevant to what their life was or whatever. They're not encouraged to freely roam the web.
When you sign a contract for a trillion years and you are, you know, surrounded by people who are,
I think it's
all
a billion
like,
years, Brian. Let's not exaggerate.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah, come on. Yeah, you're making a mockery of this otherwise serious discussion.
But it's like, you know, when you spend this time believing, truly believing that like, you know, whatever is happening politically is a blip on the radar, and why bother to be invested in it at all? Since, you know, in you know, a fraction of your lifetime, you'll be on a different planet. That's crazy.
Yeah. It's interesting, I think, though, to look at like how some kind of offshoot organizations can sometimes, when they come more in line with what we would consider social responsibility, then become capable of doing really good things, you know? And you know, the Mormons started off as this group that sort of said, we're going off way out west to do our own thing. And now, you know, they're an important part of the American fabric. You know, there are, you know, you look at, you know, people who do public service, look a lot of different places like this, very civic minded, whatever. And it's, you know, hard to imagine, you know, our country without that part of it. Some of your, like, you know, Seventh-day Adventists were another group that was very fringy, and now they build hospitals and they do other really, you know, seem to be very focused on doing good things. And, you know, I think that, you know, the abolitionists in the 1800s and the 19th century, many of them it was a fringy sort of religious belief, you know, and they were considered these, you know, way out there sort of hippies. And the people that got on the buses to go march for the civil rights marches got on buses in church parking lots And that started off as you know, fringy sort of stuff. And so I think, you know, I'm a person, I'm not religious, and I see some religions can deviate, you know, and become more destructive. And I think some things can go more in line and adopt, let's call them humanistic principles, and say, okay, the people right now are very important, and that's how we serve our belief. And so it'd be interesting to see where some of these things are 100 years from now.
Yeah, man.
Like, do they get a certificate? Like, should we have like a graduation ceremony where you go from like cult to religion?
Yes, I believe it's called tax exempt status. That's what you get.
Which, by the way, that among the many amazing chapters in Inside Scientology, maybe the most fascinating is how Scientology got tax exempt status and just a concerted effort, according to people that were involved in that book. It tells a harrowing tale of the IRS being put on the defensive as Scientology presses them through tactics, both legal and many illegal, to force them into giving them tax-exempt status, and then the U.S. government caving. Yeah.
Always attack, never defend seemed to be the credo during that phase.
Speaking of which, you can attack our Weird Things page on Patreon. That's patreon.com/weirdthings.
Heck yeah, man. You could attack it with your dollars, and we'll countermeasure with lots of fun insights about the strange, the paranormal, and the future of mankind. We so far have 434 members of our Congress of Weird, our legion of awesomely strange out there. They're donating. We're still at 2/3 of our goal of $1,000 per episode. But so far, they made it possible for us to commit to being here every single week for you guys. They've given us enough extra scratch that we could afford to bring in the fabulous Bryce Neshcom Castillo. How you doing, Bryce?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Good. That's right. Yeah. And by the way, if you're watching the live feed, he is a danged wizard of listening to what we're saying and posting links right alongside everything in the chat. And of course,
amazing.
You can watch us live at diamondclub.tv every Sunday at around 4 o'clock, give or take, Central Time.
Just like appearing out of the ether. Amazing.
From out of nowhere.
We're ghosts.
All right. Gentlemen, I'm gonna blow your mind holes with an idea, a concept. I mentioned this a little bit to Justin, and I've seen the future. Now, there's a guy, his name escapes me. We never talk about him. Has a company, I can't remember, that makes cars.
Henry Ford.
No. Last name, I think, had kind of a similar number of letters. Makes
Lyndon Johnson.
I think it's an electric car. You know, he does that. Anyhow, he announced that
Nikolai Einstein.
Something. Anyhow, but he announced that the cars that they make, I guess the ones since October, are actually capable of doing like kind of semi-robotic driving already.
What?
And that they have them like driving from like, you know, they can drive from one of them, like they've like test ones that can drive from San Francisco to Seattle, right?
Okay. So I missed this news story. So did he just like, you know, did he tweet this out? Did he Instagram like cars driving itself? LOL. So can yours?
No. Well, he came out this week and said that there was a big announcement that they were going to end range anxiety when it came to Tesla cars. And so the official big announcement, the reason why they were out there was basically – this is like the final FU to that one dude who wrote the negative Tesla review about not being able to get to a supercharger in time. So now you will basically know, like you will have to X out of two different screens to run out of power. Like it's going to tell you not only how far, how much power you have, but where the next supercharger is and will like guide you in that direction upon the car realizing that it needs juice. On top of that, and the fact that like that whole range anxiety solution is going to be pushed as an over-the-air update to the car's internal system, is also this idea that like, oh yeah, BT dubs, they're also as part of that will be limited robotic driving. However, understand you know, much like when Will Ferrell is working on his car in the front yard of in Old School. This ain't exactly street legal in certain places. Yeah. So, you know, keep it to your private estates.
So in 3 months' time, they're releasing a software update, which will include an auto drive functionality, right now you'll be able to engage auto steering on highways. But basically, it means a Tesla on the road today with the software update. I guess anyone built since October. According to Musk, is technically capable of going from parking lot to parking lot. But we won't be enabling that for users with this hardware suite because we don't think it's likely to be safe in suburban neighborhoods. he says it because those streets often lack posted speed limit signs, etc. But he says in the future, drivers will be able to summon an unmanned Model S to a location or direct the car to itself in the garage.
I'll tell you what, man. The biggest leap we could get to is I just want to be able to get on the highway, click a button, and know that I got 2 hours to read a book, play some video games, do whatever, and then, like, you know, as we get close to the exit, disengage and take back manual.
Well, thing. He said this should not be confused with a proper self-driving car. He says there's certainly an expectation when an autopilot on a Model S is enabled that you're paying attention, but it should also take care of you if you have moments of distraction.
Yeah, man. Well, and this is that weird social dance they have to do about saying what they can say in public, because there's tremendous liability. And also, you know, if you're dealing with your stock valuation, you don't want to say anything irresponsible or overstate that either blows up or gets you in trouble later.
Yeah, I think that, you know, they're drawing the distinction between autopilot and self-driving. Like, I have a... You know, there are cars right now on the road that have, like, these automatic, like, when you put it in cruise control, they have collision avoidance. And so you put it in there, it won't let you run into the car in front of you. You know, that's a feature. And here now he's been able to combine a lot of these self-driving functions into there, but called autopilot. But anyhow, what we're seeing, though, right now is a car that's on the road that has a lot of what we would describe as being close to what this is. I had this idea, and I'm not original to this, I'm sure, but I was thinking about, like, man, it'll be really cool. Would be in, you know, 10 years or whatever, when we actually have the laws and stuff that allow us to have robo cars. You know what I want?
What?
Robo RV. A robo Winnebago. A robo Bago.
Oh, just take you on a tour around the United States?
Dude, just roaming the country in my auto, my house that drives itself.
And it's all electric powered, so it just gets you from station to station. You sit there just lounging. That'd be amazing.
Take a nap in the back, watch some Netflix, just roam forever.
Our friend CJ Johnson is kind of doing exactly that. He got a giant freaking RV that he takes to all his gigs now. And so, you know, when he's done, you know, I think it'd be awesome to have a private jet take me back home. He walks out into the parking lot and he's home. Hey, so I tweeted something that I didn't think was very controversial, but it started a firestorm of arguments. Like, I can't think of anything in the last 5 months that has upset more people than me linking to one of these announcements by Elon Musk, in which I believe he says that in the future, you know, it'll seem irresponsible to let people handle these death machines.
Did he say it that way?
I mean, that's the way it was quoted in the headline. I'm sure Bryce.
Because he says he hopes people will always be able to drive cars.
Well, he clarified that because, yeah. but he was talking about public perception, and yeah. I think he's 100% right. I think that within 5 years we'll have enough of these on the road that we will see their exemplary safety record. We're gonna see when you see 2-3 orders of magnitude fewer accidents with computer
controls. 5 years.
Well, I mean, we're seeing them on the road today. Yeah, you don't think we'll see a safety record in 5 years?
I think that the percentage of ones that'll be on the road in 5 years with, and we're talking autopilot versus self-driving stuff. I mean, statistically, where do most accidents take? I don't know that we'll see enough of a statistical jump in 5 years' time, because I don't think there will be enough of these cars on the road by then.
Well, here's my supposition. This is what I was thinking when I wrote it, right? What I figure is 5 years, like, considering that we essentially have them on the road today, but people can't buy them, the fact that we're talking about, you know, new Teslas being able to be upgraded, I'm going to say that we have 1,000 to 5,000 cars driving themselves on highways within 5 years. And that we have enough of a
I'm sorry, clarify, I mean, do you mean autopilot or full robo mode?
I'm picturing autopilot. Just get on the highway, press a button, and whatever. And then once we have, you know, you figure 1,000 to 5,000 cars. You figure each of them doing, I don't know how many, you know, maybe 20, 30,000 miles a year on there. You know, now we're up to about a million road miles of cars driving. And when you see, you know, an under 1%, an under 0.01% accident rate, I feel like 5 years from now will be, it will, I'm not talking about implementation, I'm talking about perception. Mm-hmm. I think enough numbers will be in that all of a sudden people will be just running full speed to get this and is enabled on as many things as possible. And I think the thing that pissed people off about my tweet was I said, what I said was in 5 years, it'll look ridiculous that we let people drive our cars. Now, what I meant is present tense. I think that, 5 years from now, we'll have enough data that will look like if you're buying a car for your 16-year-old, you will make sure that you buy one with auto drive or autopilot or whatever enabled because it's in, it will look insane by the numbers to let humans do this.
I don't know time frames, but I do think that like airbags and stuff, it will be a point like first, like seat, why would I want a seatbelt? Why would I want an airbag? I agree. I think at a certain point it'll be like, but it might be incrementally like the collision avoidance stuff first. It'll be like that thing. It'll be like, oh, why wouldn't I have a car with collision avoidance? You know, why wouldn't I have a car with these other things? I think it might be a grab bag of features, but you know, there are 2 billion cars out there. We only produce like 100 million a year, so it would take 20 years to replace them all.
Oh, sure. Now keep it. And this is what people misread it as, is they thought that I meant past tense. Like in 5 years, everyone will have self-driving cars and we'll think it's dumb and the government will make it illegal to drive your own cars. I don't think that's the case at all. I think we're looking at 30 years plus before we get to a point where there's even, you know, like dedicated auto drive only lanes in the on the highway. But man, did people freak out and start attacking me saying that I don't even know what they thought I was saying, but they didn't like it.
I didn't know the current state of like what was in cars until, you know, Tesla made announcements and then you realize, oh, yeah, you know, BMW has this feature. Other cars have this feature. Like a lot of luxury high-end cars have features now, like they can tell you the speed limit signs. This collision avoidance system, you know, it's a $10,000 system in cars, which will come down dramatically in prices. I think that we're going to start getting a lot of these. I think that you're going to get collision avoidance is going to be one of the big steps you're going to have. And then I think that the big thing for luxury cars will be to pursue more self-park. And you're going to see a thing, I think, in shopping malls and other types of areas of private locations, you're going to see an endorsement for shop. Because like L.A., everywhere you got a valet. But you pull in somewhere and it's like, oh, no, this is an auto park zone. If your car has auto park, stop here, get out, and, you know, it can park. I think that'll be a big feature.
Well, but I guess in terms of perception, if what we are looking at are safety enhancements, then really – like I don't know what needs to happen for us to flip the bit and say, well, humans shouldn't drive or like these things need to be mandatory. Like I just kind of feel
and again, neither of those were things I said or even believe. I think that this is the leap is everyone's like, oh, you want laws saying that humans can't drive? I'm like, no. I mean,
no,
like,
you just want to ban humans, Brian.
Yeah, it's like smoking. It's like smoking is totally legal, but it's generally perceived as irresponsible and not something you want your kids to do. And that's the way I think we'll feel.
Unless your kids are cool.
About well, that's yeah. The other thing that's similar to it is that it's something that will make you look really, really cool.
Well, I guess I'm kind of confused as to what the conversation is. What is the conversation that you felt people were not allowing you to have?
Just where perception will be as far as acceptance of self-driving cars in 5 years. I think in 5 years we'll have enough data and enough cars on the road that in general, like if you're going to buy a car, all things being equal, the right, safe, responsible thing to do to buy a car for your 16-year-old is to get one that has auto drive enabled, and it will look insane. Like you will think less of a parent that buys one that doesn't have auto drive capability.
In the same way that you would think bad about somebody who would buy a car without seatbelts or an airbag if those weren't legally mandated.
Yes, and we will think those people are crazy and irresponsible, just like we think smokers are crazy and irresponsible. That was my thesis that nobody wanted to hear.
Yeah, but everyone wanted. So the argument there is whether or not these things come so far down in price that it is a nominal upcharge, or like it is like something less than an extra $10,000 on top of
the first people to react in a large scale thing will be insurers. I think that you'll see dropped insurance rates go down a lot. They're the first ones paying attention to the statistics. And like, just like with anti-lock brakes, things like that, I think you will see insurance companies saying, oh yeah, no, we'll, it's a third less if your car has this.
And then all of a sudden you get into that what a math phase where you're able to justify the increased expense because you're going to save so much on your insurance.
And it might be a backdoor way we talked about getting into where you have like robo lanes where it might be like, you might have, oh, you know, the HOV lane, or cars equipped with, you know, this feature, you know.
Yeah. You've already seen that in California, you know, with you know, zero emission vehicles get certificates, you know, for the HOV lane. So you can, you know, you can see all the Priuses with one people in them scooting on down the HOV.
And can you imagine also, like, instead of HOV, we'll have an ultra HOV lane, which means, like, because once you have cars doing it, you don't need a 2 second following distance between vehicles. You can have them, you know, 5 feet away from each other doing 100 miles an hour and everything running at once. In which case, right, you know, like it would be literally irresponsible to allow a human being on that speed train.
Gentlemen, I'm going to change the topic.
Let's hear it. Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about what you're going to do when you're in your robocar. I sent you a link, Brian. Magic Leap, we talked about before. We said since Microsoft HoloLens came out, we'd be hearing more out of Magic Leap. Well, Magic Leap was supposed to do, they're the ones developing this augmented reality system where through some means, maybe goggles, maybe things projected directly into your eyeballs like we've talked about before, through some means, they layer artificial reality on top of your reality.
Wait a minute. I did not know that this dropped. Is this is officially from Magic Leap visualization? Leap.
Yep. Okay. Brian is playing the video right now. Describe what you're seeing.
Okay. You see first-person perspective, somebody in their office. It looks like he's got a GoPro strapped to his head. And overlaid over it with reasonably good motion tracking is all of these icons and elements. He looked at his computer and a Gmail icon popped up. Let me turn this up and see what we got. Man, if it's that smooth.
Get ready. Hold on to your butts.
Okay, so he walks over to an empty table and a bunch of phasers show up on it. He picks his robot gun.
They're Gordbot blasters, of which I own one.
All right, and then now he's, I assume, about to play a real-life video game. Oh, my God. Is this really what it would look like?
Right. Robots are falling from the ceiling in his office. Blasting them.
Oh, my gosh. Powerness range.
Yeah.
He's setting up a turret. Around cubicles are coming more robots that he's blasting. You know what I love about this video? Is they spent all of 20 seconds essentially saying, yeah, productivity. Anyway, robots and blasters in your cubicle farm.
A tank just broke through the wall and is driving into the office.
Holy cow, man. When did this video drop? How did I miss this?
This week. I just saw it. So, and it's on the Weird Things list, by the way, too. If you want to sign up at the $2 level on the Patreon, you will get every day or so, sometimes a couple times a day. Sometimes a couple days, there's nothing that weird going on, but you get these updates. But anyhow, there's been some questioning of how realistic is the, I mean, it's very robots falling to the ceiling. This was the video, like the graphics and stuff was by the Weta Workshop, this Peter Jackson company that does the our collaboration that did the special effects for The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, really good special effects house. But there's some question, like they've asked Magic Leap, like, okay, is this like real footage or is this like it's going to be like this footage? And somebody pointed out, if you go back and you watch the original Google Glass video, and you go, wait, that's not what we got. What we got in the Google Glass video was like this full frame middle of this thing. You actually had some tracking with stuff in there. And then what we got was this little thing that floats up in the corner, you know, that's kind of sort of there, you know?
Yeah. I'm trying to find that video here. I haven't found it yet, but oh, here we go. Yeah. I'm looking at the original video. I didn't realize what a misrepresentation it is, because if you look at this wow, a trip down memory lane here. 2 years ago, you're seeing essentially the same thing. Somebody's looking at the world, and then you see, like, overlaid with reality, almost like augmented reality.
Yeah.
That's nothing like what we got.
Oh, no.
Wow, I didn't even want to look at this. I'm so mad.
Yeah, that was one of the frustrating things with Google Glass was like that first video. You're like, it was like, oh, it looked like what HoloLens and Magic Leap are supposed to be, where it's really this overlaid reality instead of this little heads up display up in the upper corner of your vision for one eye. You know, and that was the frustrating thing. Like when
and by the way, I still think that there's a place for that kind of heads up display in specific things, but not at $1,500. Like I would probably pay. I do enough serious cycling that I would pay $200 for a heads up display that had, you know, number of calories, current speed, wind conditions.
I think sure, and I think that like a camera that like an it's like if you go out you go sightseeing whatever a really good sunglass camera or whatever thing that's always on that you could then like say oh yeah save that say, would be really I think there's a lot of neat things but to try to put
that
it
was,
out
that was like, that was really the only you know the only killer app on Google Glass was you know it took really good video it took okay pictures and you know to network that and to be able to just be like oh cool like share that. Like that was a cool idea that it got close to. Everything else was just kind of garbage.
So right now, Carl in the chat's asking, how longer will we have to wait without a physical object from Magic Leap? And that brings up a good point because Magic Leap is in that weird fundraising phase where it's important to generate hype because you could generate more seed money, but there's only so much you could do that before you start to lose the audience here.
Well, I don't know that, like, I mean, they're funded to $500 million right now.
Right.
They've got, and they've been bringing on board, too, like, game, like, some crazy, like, you look at who they brought on, game developers and other people, like, they've been hiring some amazing talent within what they're doing. So I think that they're in a little bit of spend happy phase right now because they've got $500 million in funding. What I think they're trying to do is that I think that HoloLens, like, they weren't worried about Oculus because Oculus is a totally immersive reality thing and where this is this augmented reality where the difference is between being able to incorporate into your real world versus being shut away in this thing. But I think that they're happy to let Oculus and now Steam system looks really good for VR. They're happy to let them do that. But when Microsoft announced HoloLens, I think that's when Leap got said, all right, Magic Leap's like, we need to get the narrative back.
We need to own this space because they could look at Oculus as a neighbor. They could look at Steam as a neighbor. But HoloLens is a direct competitor. And they're like, we need to own. Yep. We need to be first in the mind.
Well, yeah. I mean, not to mention funded by a company that has, you know, all the money in the world to burn and continue to stake out claim. You know, it's not like some other startup that is more like that has to face the same problems they do in terms of raising money. You know, came out and made a big splash. Like this is Microsoft. You know, they do swing a very big bet.
Yeah, and so to clarify for audience, Magic Leap has got a lot of funding commitment from Google. Their total funding commitment they have is something like $500 million, with hundreds of millions of dollars of that coming from Google, and it's very separate from Google Glass. It's not part of Google Glass. Magic Leap is a separate company, but in Google is an investor. And you know,
what's your take on this, Andrew? Is this the Google Glass demo video syndrome where we just want to get excited about this idea, but the actual implementation is going to be super jank?
I think that what makes Magic Leap interesting to me, it's the underlying idea of how do you overlay video on top of what you're seeing. And what they're talking about, we've talked about this a couple years ago about the real future is going to be in basically retinal projection or projecting stuff into your eye, not looking at a screen, but actually having images projected into your eyeball, which is what it looks like they're doing. And their patents are around that. And it may be the first one, maybe to quote the Chakram, the first version of it might be kind of janky to an extent, but you get certain leaps that it's hard to appreciate at the time. But then when you see the refined versions of it, you know, touchscreens have been around like since the 60s, essentially. But once you got, you know, the capacitance touch, once you got the kind of really good touchscreens that you now find on iPhones and Android devices, and you could really understand that you could have finely tuned touch, you could do multi-touch, the idea of interacting with the screen became very different. And with this, you know, the first examples of this sort of technology, it may be, well, you know, my Oculus has a better resolution as this, as this. But then it has the opportunity to progress to the point where if we get, you could build, like what Google Glass showed us, you could make that now. You could make what that demo video was. They, in a rush to try to deliver a product at $1,500 and do this and all that, they made a lot of compromises. But I think that we're going to get what Magic Leap and HoloLens have. Maybe it'll be 5 years. It may not be 5 months, but maybe it'll be 5 years.
So here's the other question is how much of the capability of the item do you build into the standalone product? Because I almost, let's say it was $2,000. You will have a hard time getting me to spend $2,000 on anything self-contained because I know the processing power and battery requirements or whatever will be so much better so quickly that just like we saw with Google Glass, it'll be in this fast-moving space, it'll be irrelevant within a year or two. But if it was $2,000 just for the display and you could either maybe connect it to a portable pack that you wore for, you know, playing a 30-minute video game or whatever, or connect it to your computer where you would infinitely be able to upscale the processing power behind it. So in other words, it enters more that display space. You know, televisions have a 7-year replacement cycle compared to like, you know, consoles or set-top boxes have like a 2-year replacement cycle on that.
Well, we know with HoloLens, Microsoft thing, they say it's going to be a standalone thing and not a tethered product. And I think that's kind of a smart move because if it's standalone and it's a $400 or $500 more premium over what it'd pay to be for a tethered thing, it means there's a bigger profit margin and all that. And it's just, okay, I get this. You know, my Oculus has like a bunch of cables. And the consumer version is going to have a bunch of cables that plug into a computer. It's not an elegant, simplified solution. It'll be, and the Steam version will be the same. For gamers, it'll be fine. It is totally going to be fine for people who are used to connecting to a bunch of different peripherals. I think that, you know, I heard a really good argument, and somebody made the case that part of the reason the iPhone did so well, is that it was a year before you had an app store, but Apple put so many good features in there that when you got it, and again, people are like, oh, it was crippled, like, fine. Millions of people bought them anyways, you know.
With no expectation of being able to do more than what was already on that home screen.
And that was like, surf the web, not this pocket browser thing. And my, you know, from there, wonderful, you know, watch a YouTube video. Remember that was like, guess what? You'll also be able to watch YouTube videos. It was like a big, you know, a big like revelation, like, for it, you know.
This hot young startup YouTube's finally going to get the rub from Apple.
You couldn't even remember the first iPhone. You could take photos. You couldn't take video. There was a hack to do video, but it would not record video. Now you have movies in Sundance shot on iPhones that look gorgeous.
I guess, you know, and by the way, if you ever want, I still think the 07 iPhone product announcement is quite possibly the high watermark for like just presentations, like in terms of like tech presentations, like for audience reactions. And it's so funny to just see where the pops are, you know, that
like, first iPhone or the second?
First one. Or was it 06 was the first one? Yeah, because then it came out later. But like when Steve does the scroll and it's just like the regular motion, it's like, ah! It's like, you know, like Showtime at the Apollo, like level.
whoop, whoop, whoop.
Yeah. Oh, no. People are jumping up and down, lying on the floor. It's crazy. So... with this, like, I just kind of wonder where, because I agree with you that like the big jump is going to be the retinal projection. It seems to be that that's where they have a lot of confidence in wearability and not getting people sick based on it because your eye isn't tracking this, like.
You had the head of Leap, Abramovitz or Abram. He's trash talking HoloLens. He's like, oh, you know, you're just gonna eye strain, blah blah blah. Ours is better, and Microsoft's like, whoa, you haven't even touched ours. So like, you're already getting this trash talk between them as far as, you know, my imaginary vaporware is better than your imaginary vaporware.
I mean, you know who wins when this kind of showdown happens, right? Us.
We do.
No, man. It's like how much better did iPhone start getting wicked fast once Android came to have a pissing match with them?
Well, certainly in terms of you know, development and you know, feature wise. I mean, you've seen you know, Apple, you know, continue to allow. I mean, just even to see another operating system kind of test features and see like, okay, well, this is good. This makes sense from a UI perspective. People really like this. This is dumb. We should not do this, or we should wait on these features until they get to a certain level for Apple to do stuff. No, absolutely. I just wonder what is it retinal projection? Is that enough that you can just say like, oh, wait, I can wear these for a significant amount of time. I can actually lose myself in the world or like lose myself in this augmented version of the world and not be constantly aware of everything, you know, and is that, because if that's the case, it seems like that video is impressive yet not insane to think that it could really exist. Like, I watch that and I'm like, you know, they would be a huge leap forward. You know, I know, I think I saw Ryan Block on Twitter making fun of the fact that the person's hand is recoiling on the blaster or whatever. Although, even if you were to look at that, I mean, if you're having robots fall from the ceiling, how hard would it be to motion track your arm with the blaster and make
it? We don't know that's their hand either. You know, I mean, it could be.
Well, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I guess there's a lot of other solutions that you could do for that. You know, so like, I don't know. It seems plausible. And if that's the case, then Magic Leap, I mean, obviously battery life, price, you know, that kind of stuff very much plays into it. But this seems like it could really be, you know, this could be a thing.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. I mean, it's very exciting to have two big companies going at it. Now, somebody pointed out in the chat room, says, well, which the VR form that will win will be the one that porn adopts. That's a misnomer. Porn tries to put itself onto every single platform, including the Google Glass, which they no longer manufacture at this point in time. So it's fun to say, but it's not really true.
Well, I mean, it certainly was based in historical accuracy. That was a big reason why VHS won over Betamax. But you're right in that, you know, porn producers, they just want to get their stuff into whatever method they can as cheaply as they can.
Yeah. Gentlemen, say we do some picks.
Yeah.
Porn picks.
Right. Hey, I got a pick. I like this show 30 Rock, and so I went and gave a spin to The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt on Netflix, the new Tina Fey and her husband show, and I liked it quite a bit. I thought that it's – I can't remember a recent show with a darker premise than that they play as lightly – as they do. If you are unfamiliar with the concept of the show, remember the Cleveland women who were trapped and kept prisoner in this in some lunatic's basement, and you know, the retrieval of them spawned the dead giveaway auto-tune the news song. This is basically a riff off that, where Kimmy Schmidt, our central character, is you know, a survivor of a kidnapping for years. She got kidnapped as a child, and now she's 30 years old and living in New York City. But it's a really dark premise that they kind of dance around really, really, really remarkably. I very much enjoyed it, and in terms of the comedy itself, if you dig 30 Rock, I think you'll probably dig this. There's
So is it Kenneth the Page as a chick?
There's a lot of that, you know, and you can tell that they like, you know, writing these kinds of archetypes, you know, because her roommate has elements of kind of a Tracy Morgan sort of thing. And I know that there was a cameo in 30 Rock where Carrie Fisher played an old hero of Liz Lemon's, and there the their landlord is very much in that vein of a character with some of the one-liners and this old 19 gritty New York kind of
line up, Liz. It's the 90s.
So yeah, it's I really liked it.
How many episodes in are you? Did you finish the whole thing?
I finished it, yeah.
Okay. Because I got two episodes in, and to be honest, I didn't have really any desire to go back to it. But then Tom hit me up saying, like, oh, no, episode 4 is really a do-or-die one. Just skip to that one, and if that doesn't take you, nothing will.
Did you like 30 Rock?
I only saw a couple episodes here or there, and from what I understand, like, the more of it you watch, the better it got, because you got a real handle on all the characters.
It is a very specific kind of taste, like I don't think that it's anything that I would like look down on somebody if they didn't dig, it's extraordinarily pop culture centric and it scratches a very specific comedy itch for me. I don't think it is a one size fits all kind of thing. And also it's very, both shows and this one probably more so than 30 Rock is very like love letter to New York, kind of stuff. So if that's, something that doesn't necessarily resonate with you, then I think that it's going to miss a little bit.
Well, according to Tom, episode 4 was just really good, full stop. But then episode 9, all of a sudden, there's a massive tonal shift. Like, all of a sudden, they're making jokes about heroin, Netflix, and it gets, like, darker. Like, you could tell, because the first half of these were written with the intention of them being an NBC series, yeah, primetime, traditional comedy. And then they went to Netflix, and so obviously it changed the rules about what they could get away with and what they could try.
Dude, no, there are definitely things where I was watching it and it feels like 30 Rock. It has this kind of NBC sort of aesthetic to it. And then, not to spoil something, but a fairly major character gets hooked on heroin, and in very comedic things kind of come of it and around it, and that's something that would never have gotten approved on broadcast television. So it's fun to see that flavor taken just that kind of 5 or 10 degrees. Like, it's nothing weird. It's not train spotting or anything. It's just, a character getting hooked on heroin and everybody laughs about it.
As one does. So I intercepted a bunch of chit chat between a bunch of people I respect as podcasters and as gamers who were talking up an entire genre of video game that I never got into because I was always intimidated. It was like, I'm too late to the game. I'm just going to show up and be lousy at it. But instead, thanks to Jeff Cannata, Christian Spicer, and Scott Johnson and a few other folks, they got me to try Heroes of the... What is it?
Storm.
Heroes of the Storm from Blizzard. And much like Hearthstone is this crazy mashup of all these World of Warcraft characters appearing in card form, Heroes of the Storm goes even bigger. Like, the opening starts off as you're the main character from StarCraft II. You get zapped up to an alien spaceship, and Uther Lightbringer from the Warcraft franchise explains that now you guys have to start fighting. And he's like, wait, why is this? And he's like, what's mana? Why do I have mana all of a sudden? I'm in a robot suit. And he's like, basically, like, you don't need to ask so many questions and then just go to work. And there's this self-awareness to it and a bit of ridiculousness to the premise that makes it awesome, because it's not out of character for you to click and for the character to remind you, you can hit B to do that. Why don't you do that? And then and it goes on. I'm enjoying it a lot. It's like Dota. It's a lot of running forward and running back. It's silly, it's fun, and I'm being seduced by it. Heroes of the Storm. It's in beta right now, so if you find somebody to throw you a code, it's free.
My pick is, it was theatrical released, and it just came out on video on iTunes, and I watched it Friday, and it's one of those things where when I first watched it, I loved two-thirds of it. One-third of it left me going, and so I like to go back and watch movies that the first time around, I'm like, because then going into it, my expectations have been set. Sometimes I just end up hating something even more. Sometimes I end up liking it even more. And I would say that, and I knew when I saw this in the theater, I'm like, I know I'll like this more the second time I see it because I will the edges won't be sharp. I'll know. No, I know not to stick my fingers under the seat and touch the gum.
Yeah,
it's an Andrew Mainism for you. There you go. Let that sit with you. And I'm talking about Interstellar.
Oh, did you like it more the second time through?
Absolutely, because I mean, it's when I watched it, I'm like, there is so much great stuff here. The problem is that, like, you know, there are things where it was not great. We're like, this, because like I would be watching, like, this is a beautiful thing, but I wish this hadn't happened like this, or I think the storytelling was too compressed here, or whatever. But I knew that, like, once I see it and once I go back and watch it again, I won't be as I'll know, like, okay, it's not gonna give this other thing. I won't give me what I want here, but it will give me these other great gifts and storytelling and visual. I mean, it's just, it is an amazing film. It is absolutely an amazing film, and what Christopher Nolan did there. There are, and also I could actually understand more of it listening to at home and being able to adjust the sound.
Yeah, that's right. It was the IMAX showings that had a different sound mix from other performances.
ArcLight too. ArcLight. I saw the ArcLight Dome, which is one of the premier places to go see it, where, you know, the studio engineers went and tested it. And Nolan was insistent that this is the way it was supposed to be meant. And there are scenes you can't hear, like the blast-off scene, the robot says stuff that you cannot hear it. Home video, some funny jokes made by the robot.
Yeah, so. Yeah, sure. That's amazing. Like, I've noticed that a number of things when you there are movies that I hated in the movie theater, but just seeing them on a smaller scene in a more cozy setting where you know, you where it wasn't that $20 gamble of you better impress me, makes you a more forgiving audience and you can enjoy different aspects to it.
In like my favorite was like in the blast off scene, I couldn't hear the joke in the theater, and it was as they're taking off, as Tars says, you know, as they're leaving Earth, Tars says, "So are you all ready to be slaves in my robot colony?" And that's what leads to the whole humor setting, adjust that. You know, I thought that was like, I'm like, that's a funny joke, you know?
Yeah.
And it just, I said, and I liked that because that gave us more of the personality of Tars, you know, in that, because those robots were awesome.
Well, and that's a different take than we've seen from these archetypal robots. And I believe, forgive me if I'm misremembering this, but they were either modeled on or bore a suspicious resemblance to Vincent and Bob from the Black Hole Disney shows. Whereas, like, one was more like a kind of a rugged country bumpkin, and the other was a little more, you know, professional, down to business. I wish I could remember the exact story with that.
Huh. Surprised anybody would base anything on Black Hole.
Black Hole, by the way, Black Hole is unwatchable nowadays, which is too bad.
I tried watching it again quite recently.
Oh, did you?
Yeah,
I mean, was it unwatchable?
Because it was that everybody went crazy after Star Wars to try to get science fiction properties into play, and Disney wanted this to be their Star Wars, which is, of course, you know, a dark, dark story based on The Tempest.
Yeah.
Star Wars.
Well, and also, but I'll tell you what, having said that, now it is boring and unwatchable. However, it does have very sticky, haunting images. Mm-hmm. You know, that empty, hollowed husk of a spaceship is haunts me to this day. And Justin looks like he's got to go run a game now.
Go, just go already.
See you later, guys.
All right, we should wrap this up. We'll save the rest for after things.
All right, everybody, it's been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.